Genesis 25, where we left off, and theoretically we completed it. I did want to go back and just remind you that in our last study, a survey of the scriptures, we saw the life and the death of Abraham, and now his son Isaac is married to Rebekah. Well, Rebekah was with child, you know, at near the end of chapter 25, and she actually had two boys in her womb. And they were twins, and obviously not identical twins, but they were fraternal twins. They were being born at the same time, or they were at least there at the same time. And how do you say that diplomatically? You just don't. And they were very active. It was like Studio 54 in there. You know, they're just like doing that whole. It wasn't like I felt the baby kick. It was like once every few weeks. It was like, oh, there was 2 seconds where a baby wasn't kicking, kind of thing. They were very active. And it got to the point where Rebekah prayed and said, Lord, what's the deal with this? And he said, well, there's two nations in your womb, which would kind of scare me. I mean, it's like, wow. But actually, it was the patriarchs, the two fathers of what would ultimately be the Edomites and the Israelites. And they were struggling with one another. Even in the womb, they were at odds, as they would be for much of their lives. Now, when the children were born, the first one came out. They named him Esau because he was a redhead and hairy all over. He was like a big red gorilla kind of thing. And I'm trying to think of somebody that you could probably think of, but I'll have to leave that to your imagination. And on the way out, there's this little hand grabbing the first little foot. You know, as Esau's being delivered, there's this little hand grabbing the foot. And it was grabbing his heel. It was like he wanted to be first. And so they named the second boy Jacob, which means heel catcher. And really, that's kind of a slang Hebrew term for trickster, you know, sneaky guy. And so they named him Jacob, which means heel catcher. And so as these two boys grew up, Esau and Jacob, they grew up, they got to be very, very different. Esau was a man's man. He liked hunting. You know, if there were guns around back then, he would have liked guns. He would have been into NASCAR, you know. He was a hunter. He was a sportsman. He was dad's favorite. Jacob was mom's favorite because Jacob liked to cook. He was an indoorsy type, and he liked to hang curtains and stuff. I mean, Jacob was just an indoors guy. He was a very peaceful guy who was mom's favorite, as it says in verse 27 of chapter 25. Now, there are advantages to being the indoors, you know, chef kind of guy, because you know, you're the cook. You're the one making the good food. And it turned out to be an advantage because once Esau came in and he was just hungry, he was hungry, you know, kind of thing. And he comes in and he sees Jacob cooking this lentil stew and he's like, oh, give me a bite of that red stuff. And Jacob thinks, you know, this is an advantage. I'd love to give you a bite of the red stuff. I'd give you a whole bowl of it, but you have to, I'm going to sell it to you, you know. Sell it to me? What do you mean? You know, I want your birthright as the firstborn. Well, what good is that to me? I'm dying of hunger here. Okay, sure. Esau was a guy given to exaggeration. And so he sold his birthright for a bowl of stew. And by the way, that red bowl of stew, when he said red stuff, that's where he got the name Edom. Because he looked at the bowl of lentils and said, oh, I want to eat them. No, actually Edom. They're going to stone me. Actually, Edom means red, so just so you know that. But you'll never forget that, Esau's other name, Edom. So that's the end of chapter 25, and now when we start in chapter 20, see, you already got a good story and a good laugh. We haven't even started yet. So we get to chapter 26. And we find out that there's a famine in the land. There was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, don't go down to Egypt. Stay in this land of which I tell you. Sojourn in the land and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands. And he begins to describe the same blessings that Isaac's father Abraham had been told by God. And God is getting very specific, saying, hey, I told Abraham this, now I'm telling you this, Isaac. Now, unfortunately, have you ever heard the term the sins of the father become the sins of the son? Well, in verse 7 of this chapter, when the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, oh, she is my sister. Okay, let's at least get an original story here. It's a bad thing because as you're pretending to be brother and sister. The whole reason was because, you know, this forcible wife taking, you know, they kill you and take your wife. He was trying to avoid dying. But the problem was here that if you're going to pretend to be brother and sister, you need to behave like brother and sister. Because in verse 8, it says that when they had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. So this is not a good thing. You know, it's like if you're going to pretend to be somebody, pretend to be somebody. And Abimelech calls him in and says, hey, man, you know, somebody could have taken your wife and you know, this would have been brought curses of God down upon us. What are you doing? And like father, like son, again, there was the secular rebuke, the man of God being rebuked by the pagan guy. And so we see that as Isaac dwells in the land of the Philistines, that Isaac sowed in the land and reaped in verse 12, and it says, in the same year reaped a hundredfold. Man, his fields were just blessed. The Lord blessed him, it says. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. And he had all these things. Well, the problem was that he got so rich there that they told him to move. Oh, we don't like you. You know, you'll get out of here kind of thing. And so they said, you know, we want you to move down the street. We want you to move down the path. We don't like the fact that you're here and you're getting so wealthy. But even when he moved, the Philistines continued to dispute with him about water rights, that his father Abraham had dug many wells and they had either stopped them up or claimed that they were theirs. They say, no, no, these are our wells. And I don't know why, but tonight the Philistines are Russian. And maybe because I'm trying to get through 26 chapters and I am also Russian. And I hope this doesn't become like a Calvary tradition. That's and so throughout this whole thing, God's reassuring him, you know, hey, Isaac, you're going to inherit the promises that I gave to your father Abraham. Now, meanwhile, at the end of chapter 26, look how quick we're going through this. At the end of chapter 26, in verse 34, when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith. You'd think, Judith, well, that's a good Jewish woman, right? Well, no, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite and Basemath. That's when they send you back because you're no good at algebra. And the daughter of Elon the Hittite. So he marries these Hittite women. Now, these are not of the family of the Hebrews. And it grieves, it says, and they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Hey, don't be marrying the Hittite women. And, you know, they were like, for whatever reason, the parents didn't like, you know, they didn't like their daughters-in-law kind of thing. Well, as chapter 27 opens up, this is a pretty famous story that as we learn the history of it, we find out that most of us heard it in Sunday school or we've heard some version of it, that Isaac is old and he can't see anymore. He's got, whether it's cataracts or he's gone blind, he's just too old to see anymore. And he wants some lean cuisine kind of thing, you know, but there's no microwaves and there's no freezers. And so he calls Esau in and says, oh, you know, go shoot me an animal and then cook it up. And I just really, really wanting some meat and make me this dish of game such as I love. And Esau is like, well, sure. You know, okay, I guess I could do that. And he said, and when you get back, Esau, I'm going to bless you because, you know, I'm getting old and, you know, I want to give you the blessing. I want to speak a prophetic blessing over you. And now Esau is excited and he goes out. He's going to go hunt down a deer or something and make some venison stew. And unfortunately, Rebekah, Isaac's wife, Esau wasn't her favorite. Jacob was her favorite. And she's here listening. She hears this. Oh, no. My least favorite son's going to get the blessing, not my most favorite son. Jacob, Jacob, come here, come here. This is what we got to do. I want you to go out to the barn and get a couple of goats and kill them, slaughter them up, and we'll cook your dad some stew. And then we're going to have you get the blessing. And he's like, well, great plan, Mom, except, you know, Esau is, well, he's hairier than I am. He's a man's man. Don't forget that. And she said, oh, it's okay, because when we kill the goats, what we'll do is we'll put the goat fur on the back of your neck and on the back of your hands. And so that you smell like a man of the field, we'll have you put on Esau's clothing. Okay, sure. So they kill the goat, cook up the stew, come in. He's all dressed up, and he's like, here's your stew, Dad. You know, who is that? Esau, Dad. Well, you know, the smell is my son Esau, but the voice is my son Jacob. Come here, let me feel the back of your neck. Oh, he's hairy like Esau, and he fools Dad. He fools Dad into thinking that he's Esau. And so he speaks a blessing over him, a prophetic blessing, saying that, hey, may nations bow down to you and be master over all your brothers. He just spoke the blessing to the wrong guy. Not the wrong guy as far as God was concerned, but the wrong guy as far as everyone else was concerned. And so Jacob receives this blessing. Well, just at the end of at the end of the blessing, Esau comes in, and you could just picture how this TV show would go. You know, it's like, he's like, amen, and then the door opens, and Esau comes in. He's got this freshly killed game. He cooks it up, you know, and he brings it in. He's like, all right, Dad, here's your stew. I can't wait for that blessing, you know, and he's like, who's in my room? What do you mean who's in your room? You know, Esau. What do you mean? I just gave the blessing to Esau. No, Dad, that wasn't me. And, you know, everybody's mad. Esau got so upset. Isaac, the dad, the blind dad, trembles with anger. He's so upset. Well, Esau is murderously angry. And he plots and says, I'm going to kill Jacob. Well, as soon as Mom, Rebecca, finds out about this, she says, Jacob, you got to get out of the house. As a matter of fact, you got to get out of town. My brother Laban lives off in that direction. Go that way. Well, you know, I can't just run away. Okay, I'll convince your father. So she goes and she walks in, and Isaac's sitting there in bed blind, and she's like, honey, what's the matter now? You know,
well, it's just that, you know, Isaac's going to get married soon, and it's going to be one of these Hittite women, you know, and I'm thinking he should go back to Laban's.
And so he said, okay, let him go. And so he goes off to Laban's house. Well, as we get to chapter 29, hey, you're reading ahead of this anyway, I just know. And so when we get to chapter 29, Jacob goes on and he encounters basically all of chapter 29, just about. Jacob arrives at Haran, where his uncle Laban lives, and he meets this woman, Rachel. And you know, she's a knockout. This is the woman I want to be my wife, and finds out that it's Uncle Laban's daughter. Now, I know that whole first cousin thing seems kind of weird, but back then apparently it was okay. And so Laban welcomes Jacob into his house, and he stays there for a month. Well, verse 15 rolls around, and Laban says to Jacob, because you're my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? You know, now he's Irish. And he says, what should your wages be? Just because you're my relative doesn't mean you should work for free. You've worked for free for a month. What do you want your pay to be? And Jacob said, well, $140 million. Oh, I'm sorry. That was the guy from the stock market. He said, well, I'll tell you what. In payment for the next 7 years' work, I'll take your daughter Rachel as my wife. Laban says, okay, it's a deal. And so he works for 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, there's his wedding. And, you know, the dress and the veil and everything. And they go and have this. They go on their honeymoon. And you know, they didn't. How do you say this diplomatically? The Hebrews didn't go anywhere for their honeymoon except, you know, upstairs. And they didn't take the veil off in the wedding ceremony. They took it off the next morning. Well, poor Jacob. Jacob has the wedding and has the honeymoon evening, and in the morning lifts his wife's veil, and it's Rachel's really ugly older sister, Leah. The name Leah, and I apologize if that's what your parents, you know, chose to name you, but for this case, I need to tell you, it means cow-eyed. Now, and so she was not easy on the eyes, and I can't make these things up. Again, you know, you can call your mom and yell at her later if you want, but Jacob's upset, understandably so. He's just married the wrong woman, and he worked 7 years to get her. He confronts Laban angrily and says, "Oh, you deceived me." And Laban says, "Well, here's the deal. It's not our custom to marry off the younger woman before we marry off the older woman. You know, the sisters here, it's only right that the older one gets married first. But I'll make you a deal. You work for me another 7 years and you can marry Rachel." All right. He loved Rachel. He didn't love Leah. He didn't love her. He loved Rachel. Well, then at chapter 29 and verse 31, the Lord saw that Leah was unloved and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And so Leah conceived and bore a son. So the first of these two wives has a son. The unloved one has a son. She names him Reuben. And then they actually have several sons. They have with Leah, because Rachel is not able to have children, Leah gives birth to four sons to Jacob: Simeon and Reuben and Levi and Judah. And these guys, most of which you've heard these names, they are the fathers of the tribes of Israel. You know, the tribe of Levi, the people that cared, the servants of God who cared for the temple, many of whom ended up being priests. They were the descendants of this son of Leah and Jacob, the son named Levi. Judah, certainly you know that we know, actually you probably know personally a guy who's of the tribe of Judah. He's the lion of the tribe of Judah. So you know him. And so anyway, Rachel couldn't have any kids and she's feeling pretty left out. She decides to do the same thing that grandma did and said, "Well, here's my maid. Why don't you have kids with her? It'll count like having kids with me." And so Bilhah, the maid, is given to Jacob. And so Bilhah gives birth to Dan and Naphtali, also the names of tribes of Israel. And Leah wasn't having any more children at this point for whatever reason. And so she gives her maid to Jacob. This is three too many wives at this point. You know, one is perfect. That's the way God created them to be. He made them male and female, and the two become one flesh. I don't know what four makes other than trouble. And so Zilpah, the maid of Leah, has two children, has Gad and Asher. Gad was actually his middle name. He had that like initial thing going, E Gad. Anyway. Then Leah had two more sons after that, Issachar and Zebulun, and then a daughter named Dinah. They named her that. They were on the beach when they had her, and you know, right there on the shore. And I love audience participation. Finally, hallelujah, Rachel conceives and has a child. Rachel, the loving, the wife who is loved, finally has a son named Joseph. Now, Joseph becomes a pretty big central figure in the entire rest of the book of Genesis. Now, chapter 30, verse 25, starts us out by showing us that when Rachel had born Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country." He's got four wives. He's got like a dozen kids. And he wants to go home. It's been all this time. It's been 20 years. and I want to go home. Laban is sneaky. Laban was sneakier than sneaky Jacob, you know. And Laban thinks, well, I was like a poor farmer when this guy came here, and now that he's managing all my flocks and herds and all this stuff, I'm rich. I'm hugely rich. I'm not getting rid of him. No way. And so he convinces him and says, oh, you know, no, you got to stay. And so they work out this deal that, you know, sounds like a great deal for Laban, but God blesses Jacob in the midst of it, and Jacob's herds are getting larger and larger and larger, and Laban's herds are getting smaller and smaller. And the longer Jacob stayed, the more Laban's sons, his brothers-in-law, despised him. Look at this. He's practically stealing from our dad. And it wasn't. It was an honest business deal that Laban had no belief that would work out anyway except a huge blessing to him. But God was blessing Jacob. And so the brothers-in-law, Laban's sons, were getting angrier and angrier. And finally, Jacob met with Leah and Rachel and said, we got to get out of your dad's house. Your brothers can't stand me. I think they're going to end up, you know, beating me up or something. We got to get out of here. And so the three of them decided to, you know, sneak out. And so as they decided to sneak out and leave secretly, that, where are we? We're somewhere in chapter 30. That actually we're going, yeah, we're actually in 31 now. And they take off, and it would have been okay if they had left, and, you know, Laban would have been upset. I mean, you're upset if the family leaves and doesn't say goodbye. Well, it depends on what family it is. Sometimes you just assume they leave secretly overnight. But in this case, he was pretty upset. His two daughters and all his grandchildren are, you know, just, and he's upset. But Rachel, as much as we want to like Rachel, you know, Rachel's the younger, cuter one, the one that gave birth to Joseph and later Benjamin. You know, we would think the good one. She was into idolatry, and she took her dad's household idols. And when Laban discovered that his gods had been stolen, actually, I have to interject here. Do you have a god that can be stolen? If so, you have the wrong god. It's like the little boy every Christmas praying for the pony. Oh, God, I want a pony. Oh, God, I want a pony. Oh, God. And every Christmas, he wouldn't get a pony. And so finally he goes to the Catholic church late one night and grabs the Virgin Mary statue from the little plastic one from the nativity scene and runs back into his room and props her up there and says, okay, God, if you ever want to see your mom again, anyway, if your gods can be stolen... See, that couldn't have been too bad because there wasn't a single R for that one. The daughter Rachel steals dad's, Laban's, household idols. Well, Laban's pretty upset now, and he and his men chase them down and says, hey, it's bad enough that you steal my grandkids and my wives and take off without saying goodbye, but you also steal my household idols, my little, you know, interior gods. Hey, if anybody in my party, anybody here stole your gods, today's their last day of living. You feel free to search the camp. Well, it goes through and they go tent after tent after tent, and they come to Rachel's tent, but she says, Dad, I apologize. I'm in the way of women, you know, all the, you know, guys, the commercials for stuff that we don't know anything about. She said, I don't know. You know, I'm sorry, you know, I can't stand up. Well, she's hiding all the idols there underneath the saddle that she's sitting on. So he's like, oh, that's fine, honey. And he never finds the idols. And so Jacob's like, see? Well, Jacob and Laban establish a covenant because they're both so tricky that they both say, you know what, we need to make a covenant. God's got to watch between us. That God's going to be a witness to this, that you're not going to mess with me anymore, and I'm not going to mess with you, kind of thing. And so they established this covenant together that there wouldn't be any trickery or even treachery between them in the future. Then we get to chapter 32. Jacob and company are leaving back home, traveling back home, And he decides, well, if I'm going back home, I guess I ought to open up discussion with my brother Esau again. Last time I saw him 20 years ago, he wanted to kill me. I wonder if old age has mellowed him at all. So he sends messengers on ahead. Well, word comes back from Esau to Jacob that they did get the message. And it's kind of scary because in verse 6 of chapter 32, the messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Oh. This is not good. Maybe I should have stayed at Uncle Laban's house, you know. And Jacob's greatly afraid and distressed. And look, he divides the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. For if he says, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. What a great plan. It's like the chicken plan. You know, it's like, well, everything I have and everyone, the, you know, everyone around will just split them in half. And that way, you know, it's like, half will get killed and the other half will go, run away, you know. And so there you have it. And Jacob actually prays, "Oh God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, oh Lord who said to me, return to your country." He's like telling, "Hey God, you told me to do this. Return to your country and your relatives and I will prosper you." So he's praying, saying, "Hey God, you told me to do this. It doesn't look like it's really working out and maybe you could kind of intervene here." It's nice to see that even a tricky guy like Jacob will turn to the Lord in a time of distress. And maybe we should get to the point where if our lives are written out, the times of our prayers are not just the distressed, afraid kind of times. Maybe we could get on a regular basis of prayer and then God doesn't have to make things so difficult for us, so he'll hear from us. It's like, "Oh, you never call your father," you know. It's like, "So I'll make things difficult for you." And hopefully our lives, our spiritual lives, are not like that. So he prays, and so the in verse 13, spends the night there and sends all these things. You see, 200 female goats. This is a present for his brother Esau, verse 14. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, and 20 rams. 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys, a partridge and a pear tree. And he sends them all and says, you know, "Send this on ahead and tell my brother Esau, who is traveling here with 400 men, tell him that it's a present. It's a present from me to him," hoping to appease him here. Well, we get to verse 24, that as he sends his family across the river. Now, I don't know, actually, which direction he sent them. Because if you think about it, you know, Esau, if he was facing a situation like this, you would think that he would cross the river and leave the family behind. You know, it's like, "Hey, if I'm going to face destruction, I'm going to face it myself." Well, Jacob, you can kind of picture saying to the wife and kids, to the wives and kids, "Go on ahead, you know, I'll meet up with you." So either way, he's alone on one side of the stream. We don't really know which side of the stream that is, but it says that Jacob's left alone and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "Well, what is your name?" And he said, "Jacob, trickster, heel catcher, supplanter." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Yisrael, Israel, governed by God," or "God has prevailed. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Now, it's interesting when you read this about God wrestling with Jacob, you're likely to misunderstand it or to be confused by it. Why was his name Israel, God has prevailed, when it was he who seemed to prevail against God? Or was it against God? Was it striving with God and has prevailed? And that's the trick. That's the key. A lot of people misunderstand this, but this was God who instigated this wrestling match. See, God strove with and God struggled with and God wrestled with Jacob, because tonight was the night that he was going to be submitted to God. Tonight was the night that Jacob would no longer be putting his faith in his tricks and his treachery, and he would have to put his faith in God. Because Jacob had never lived like that up to this point, and he'd always lived up to his name. Jacob, trickster, heel catcher. Wasn't going to be like this anymore. He was going to be governed by God. And so God wrestled with him. And you say, why then did God say, you have prevailed? You know what? Because when you're wrestling with God, the only way to win is to lose. The only way to win is to lose. And this is how he finally had victory. This is how Jacob had victory in his life. When he let God, he didn't let God win, but when God won, Jacob walked with a limp for the rest of his life. As a lot of us, maybe physically, maybe mentally, walk with a limp. Because God has prevailed. Because God had to get us to the point of brokenness. Whether that was physical or mental or spiritual, he got us to the point of brokenness. So we finally gave up. If you notice, Jacob was striving and struggling and wrestling God and said, I won't let you go until you bless me. What was the response to that? Injury. It was injury. And that was the blessing. That was the blessing. That he would always limp. That he wouldn't be able to run on his own anymore. He had to depend on the Lord. And he had to be governed by God. You know, it's sad when people have to get to that point where they're so rebellious against God that God makes sure they end up in prison. Makes sure they end up in a difficult situation. Very often with permanent results. But God's going to win. God's going to win, and he knows what it takes. And so I'd just as soon say, okay, God, I'd just as soon yell uncle before we get into the wrestling match. Or as soon as God goes, okay, here we go, and I say, uncle, really? Maybe I shouldn't be yelling uncle, I should be yelling father. And let God win. And that's the only way to win. That's the way Jacob prevailed, was by losing. And so at this point, he's renamed. The names will be kind of interspersed. Jacob, Israel throughout. But ultimately, he'll mostly be known as Israel, governed by God. Now, chapter 33. Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front. And Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. This guy. And yet, then he himself passes on ahead of them and bows down to the ground 7 times. Now, in ancient cultures, the only one worthy of being bowed to 7 times was the king. And so this is like the ultimate humility as Jacob is submitting himself to Esau here. And Esau, 20 years has mellowed him. He's happy to see his brother again. He's blessed. And he's excited to see all these nieces and nephews and his 4 sisters-in-law. And he's happy to see, I mean, this family, and he's blessed. And he's like, oh, you know, what's the meaning of this? All these presents and stuff. I got plenty. And Jacob says, well, I got plenty too. And, you know, God's been good. And so they have a good family reunion. Well, later, Jacob moves to Shechem with the whole family. And, pardon me, in chapter 34, his only daughter, you'd think, with like 11 brothers and 1 sister, this girl would never get out. You know, I mean, it's like, if you have a daughter and a couple brothers, or maybe you were the daughter and you had a couple brothers, it's hard to get a date. Because, you know, hopefully if your brothers are loving you, they're protecting you. Well, I don't know what these guys were doing, but Dinah goes out walking around Shechem by herself, and she's violated. She's forcibly lain with, to put it as politely as possible, by the prince of the land. there in Shechem. Well, then the guy decides he loves her. He forced her first, but now he loves her. He wants to be married to her. And so he tells his dad, the king, "Oh, I want to marry this woman." And so the king goes and meets with Jacob and all of his sons and says, "Hey, my son, you know, really has a thing for your daughter and wants to get married." Now, the brothers, jumping a little too late to the defense, they are bent on revenge. And so the king comes and asks for Dinah's hand in marriage for his son. And they said they're just like dad, you know. They're like Uncle Laban and they're like dad, Jacob, the trickster. And say, "Oh, you know what? We would like nothing better than to have you in the family. I mean, we'd love for your son to be married to our sister. That's great, except here's the deal. You guys are all uncircumcised pagans. You're like, we can't have our sister marry you uncircumcised heathen pagans. But, you know, if you were to be circumcised, now that would be different." So the king says, "Okay." And so he goes back and tells his whole family, his whole household, the whole town, "Guys, this is going to be advantageous to us." You know, and this is a pretty hard sales pitch if you think about it, because it's like, "You're all going to be circumcised, but really there will be benefits. And here's the deal. This guy's got a lot of money and their daughters will marry our sons and we'll share their wealth." So the guys were so bent on getting rich that they agreed and they were circumcised. Well, at the height of their pain, 3 days later, a couple of Abraham's sons, Simeon and Levi, snuck into the city and killed every man in the entire city while they were in their painful recovery, laying in bed moaning. Killed every one of them. You know, it's easy to beat a whole lot of people. It's easy to attack a whole lot of people when they can't get out of bed. And so they wiped out the whole town. This was their revenge for the violation of their sister Dinah. Well, Jacob wasn't altogether happy with what had happened, because yes, his daughter had been avenged, but there's a whole country of Canaanites. There's an entire country of Canaanites. They're going to hear what happened here. They're going to come, they're going to amass in force, and they're going to wipe me and you guys out. And so they decided to move. Now, as he prays, "Hey, Lord, where should I move?" And the Lord says, "Go to Bethel. Go to Bethel." Bethel was a place that earlier on, and I think I skipped this in my quick comings and goings, but earlier in Jacob's life, it was on the way to Laban's house after he had been so treacherous with stealing the blessing from his dad Isaac, and or getting the blessing from Isaac and stealing it from Esau. As he was there and he laid down and slept as he was traveling to Laban's house, he had fallen asleep and had this dream of a ladder going from earth to heaven, and angels were ascending and descending on it. And God spoke to him there. And he said, "This must be like the doorway to heaven. This is the gate of God." And so he called it Beth El, house of God. Beth El, house of God. And it's funny, because that ladder has become known as Jacob's ladder. And there's something I found out in electronic school is, you know, the old Frankenstein movies with the it looks like TV antennas, but lightning's going, meh, meh. That's also called a Jacob's ladder. So don't say you didn't learn anything today. Okay. So God directs him back. Go back to Bethel. Go back to the house of God, this place where he had this dream of this ladder with the angels ascending and descending. So go back to Bethel. And there we go. As they're on their way, turns out Rachel's pregnant again. Oh, great. Rachel, you know, the loved one. The one who stole the household idols. But we like her anyway. We don't know why we like Rachel, but she seems to be the heroine of everything. And yet, when she goes into labor on the travels, that she has a really difficult delivery. difficult to the point of fatality. She dies giving birth to this last son. Well, Jacob names this last son, this youngest son, Benjamin, son of my right hand. Benjamin, the son of my right hand. And so now he's got all these kids. And this is his last one, Benjamin, the last to be named of the tribes. Tribe of Benjamin. This is the father of the tribe of Benjamin. Also in chapter 35, there's this thing in there about Reuben committing sin with one of dad's wives, one of the two maids. And it is the mother of Dan and Naphtali. And it's just the interesting thing as you read the Bible, and especially the book of Genesis, God has not covered up any of the sin of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob or Simeon or Levi or Reuben or any of these people. Again, I would remind you that the hero mentality that many of the Sunday school stories describe these great men of God to be really takes away from the fact that we're just like them. We're just like them. We mess up. They mess up. Sometimes they do such horrible things that we couldn't even imagine, and yet God is faithful to them. That's not to say that we have, you know, leeway to go do a bunch of horrible, awful things, but it is to say that you haven't been so bad that God has turned his back on you. God is faithful. I, the Lord, change not, he said, and he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Well, as we see that in chapter 35, then Jacob goes to visit his own father, Isaac. Isaac is very, very old and near death. And finally, Isaac dies. And so Esau and Jacob get together and plan the funeral and bury him. Chapter 36, you didn't know we were that far, did you? Chapter 36 describes the descendants, the actions where Esau goes and all of his descendants, and how he really became the father of the Edomites. Remember, he was called Edom. You remember why. He's the father of the Edomites. And so it describes all these kings that descended from him as the father of all the Edomites. And then we see that Joseph becomes the focal point. Joseph, the son, next, not the youngest son, Benjamin was the youngest son, but the next youngest son, Joseph, really becomes exalted above all his brothers. He's having these dreams where God is showing him that he is above his brothers. His brothers don't like it. And he's dad's favorite. He's dad's favorite. You'd think that having grown up and him not being dad's favorite, Jacob not being Isaac's favorite, you'd think that of all his sons, he wouldn't have a favorite, because that tends to mess families up pretty good. Well, it did mess him up pretty good, because he makes this young guy, Joseph, the supervisor of all his brothers who are doing work, because Joseph was good at tattling. Hey, Simeon wasn't working hard today. You know, he took a 10-minute break, and then he took a 15-minute break. You know, well, he makes him a supervisor. And how many of you have heard of the coat of many colors that was given? Okay. Here in the New American Standard, it's called the very colored tunic, but not like very colored. It was like very colored, like multicolored. Actually, a more accurate interpretation of the Hebrew there is long sleeved coat. You say, what's the big deal? He gave him a long sleeved coat? What? You know, it's like when I was a kid, I always seemed to get those big puffy jackets with no arms, you know, the vests. So you walk around like this, like the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man or something. It's like, thanks for the coat. I hate it, you know. Looking forward to another one next year. What's the big deal about a long sleeved coat as opposed to a short sleeved coat? Well, having a long sleeved coat meant that your job was not manual labor. You've heard the expression about girding your loins, about, you know, how they'd have these basically bathrobe-looking things that went down to their ankles. If they had to run, if they had to work, they'd tie them up basically like a big diaper. Well, you can't do that, and that was so they could have movement, but you can't do that with sleeves, you know, because you're hoeing and you're pushing it up, and then it falls down and you're pushing it up. And so they all had either no sleeves or short sleeves. Joseph was not given a multicolored coat, or Joseph and the great technicolor coat, or whatever they called that. It was a long sleeve coat. He was the manager. He was the supervisor over all his brothers. And that, combined with the fact that he was dad's favorite, combined with the fact that he's having all these dreams that are showing he's exalted above his brothers, they hated his guts. One day they beat him up and they threw him into a pit and thought, we're going to kill this guy. No, let's not kill him. Let's sell him into slavery. And so some slave traders are cruising by and they say, here, you know, give us $10 for this guy. And but they take his coat and they slash it all up and they dip it in blood and they send it home to dad. Dad's favorite son has been killed, torn by wild beasts, he assumes. Well, Joseph, as a slave, gets carted off to Egypt. He's sold to the commander of Pharaoh's in-house guard, bodyguard, Potiphar. Potiphar buys this slave and realizes this guy is so smart and has such managerial skills, he makes him the manager of the whole house, which would have been great, except Potiphar's wife kept bugging him, was really wanted his attention, really wanted his affection. And Joseph, being a righteous man and a man who really feared God, wanted nothing to do with it. He would not commit the sin of adultery. And he kept saying no and no and no. And finally she grabbed him by force and he ran away. Well, she's left here holding his coat, basically. And she starts screaming, assault, assault. Well, he's thrown in prison. In prison, the manager of the prison finds out, hey, this guy's got great managerial skills and he's really organized, makes him manager of the whole prison. Well, he gets a couple of cellmates a few years into this. It's a couple of cellmates that are both from Pharaoh's household. One, the baker, and one, the candlestick maker. Oh, that was something else. One, the baker, and one, the cupbearer. Because there was an attempt on Pharaoh's life. He didn't know which one had done it, so he threw them both into prison. Well, they both had dreams one night. And Joseph, being a man of God, who said, hey, you know, I can't interpret dreams, but God can. You know, go ahead and tell me what these dreams were. As it turned out, the dreams meant that one of the guys was going to be released the next day. The other guy was going to be killed the next day. And sure enough, the cupbearer was restored to his post, and the baker, you know, is dead. Joseph said, oh, you know, when you're released, remember me. Cupbearer didn't remember him. At least not until Pharaoh had a dream. Actually, a couple of dreams. And he was really troubled by it. He couldn't understand these dreams. And he's asking around, hey, can you interpret dreams? And, you know, what's the story? And the cupbearer said, hey, you know, remember that unfortunate incident when you threw me in prison? I met a guy who can interpret dreams. Pharaoh said, let me talk to him. So they dressed him all up, let him shave, and came and met with the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh told him the dream. And he said, well, this is what it means. It means that the next 7 years, agriculturally, are going to be bountiful. I mean, you're going to have all kinds of crops and everything, but that's going to be followed by 7 years of horrible, horrible, severe famine and drought. And my suggestion, with all due respect, my suggestion is, find one of these guys around here that can manage this and basically exact a tax and put this stuff in storehouses for 7 years, so that for the next 7 years you'll have an abundance and you guys be able to weather the drought. No pun intended. And so he was really humble about it. And Pharaoh said, well, I can't think of anybody better than you. And he makes him second in command of all Egypt. Second in command of all Egypt. This guy had never been to college, and he's had like 4 executive positions now. It's amazing. He's like vice president, vice pharaoh of all Egypt. And so he does that for this time, for 7 years. He's in charge of having them store up all this stuff, and they're exacting the tax of putting all this grain in the storehouses. And then a famine hits, and it's severe. It's bad. It's really bad. It's so bad that even the folks from up in the land of Canaan are coming south, because they heard that Egypt has an abundance of grain. Well, old Jacob sends his sons, not all of them. Remember, he thinks Joseph is dead, not knowing that Joseph's really vice pharaoh. Sends him down, says, go down and buy some grain, because we're starving. what the brothers don't understand when they get there is this Egyptian executive is giving them a really hard time. Like, really hard time. Like, they can say no right. They can do no right. They're accused of being spies. They're accused of being liars. They're accused of even being thieves. They're having all this difficulty. They just don't get it. Well, finally, after several chapters of this, you see how I just did that? Several chapters of this. Chapter 45. I know you're reading ahead with these things, and I haven't skipped really any of the major details. In chapter 45, it says that Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, "Have everyone go out from me." So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. This was some pretty loud crying. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. They thought they'd never see this guy again. They beat him up. They threw him into a pit. They sold him into slavery. And suddenly they realize, this guy can have us killed right now. They didn't know what to answer. But Joseph reassures them. And this is some of the most godly attribute of Joseph here, is that he reassures them. You know, me, I think that even at the height of the most godly I've ever been, I'd be exacting revenge on these guys. You tried to kill me. And the Bible says an eye for an eye, right? Well, instead he says, "Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life." Joseph was a guy who didn't focus in on the difficulties he'd experienced in life, but instead focused in on the fact that God had a plan, that God was working all things together for good for those who love him, and saw that, you know what, I was beat up, I was thrown in a pit, I was sold into slavery, I was falsely accused and thrown into prison, and then all that worked out so that I'm in this position today to save your lives. So I've saved up grain for 7 years, and now I've got it available to keep my family alive. Instead of focusing in on the fact that he was beat up and thrown into prison and all this stuff, he said, "It's okay. This was God's plan. This was God's plan." And you know what? I think that a lot of us could recover from some real bitter and unforgiving roots in our souls if we would realize that even the worst, God's working out together for good. Even when people are slandering us, beating us up verbally, or through gossip behind our backs, you know, God's still going to work it out together for good. Oh, not for them, but for us, if we respond in a godly way. And it's an important lesson to learn from the book of Genesis, is to see Joseph's godliness. And so he says, "Go back home. I want you to get Dad and everything that he has and everyone in his household and take him down here. I'll set you guys up in style. You'll survive the famine. I want to see Dad. I want to see Dad." And so in chapter 46, Israel, see how he's called, being called Israel now as opposed to Jacob. Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba, offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac, and God spoke to him in visions. And again, he reassures him and repeats the promises to him. Most of chapter 46 outline how many hundreds of people were coming with him to Egypt. And they settled in the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen. You probably remember that either from the old spiritual songs or maybe from the Ten Commandments movie. You know, with Yvonne DiCarlo. You don't know who she is. You know, Mrs. Munster. You remember her? Okay. Anyway, the land of Goshen, where they settled there in northern Egypt. They get there, they have a great reunion, and I just want you to read all these chapters. There's just so much stuff in here that as you read through this and see how this all happens and the reuniting, and then Jacob meets with the Pharaoh, and Jacob's family settles into the land of Goshen. Chapter 47, around verse 13, describes that for about 10 or so verses there, describe how Joseph, he kept being the manager, you know, the vice pharaoh. And after the first year, when everybody paid money for grain, well, now they got no money. So now what are we going to do? Well, sell me your livestock. Give me livestock, I'll give you grain. The next year, well, we don't have any livestock. How are we going to get grain from you? Sell me your land. And pretty soon, Pharaoh owned all of Egypt, all the livestock, all the land, all the people. He became like the ultimate patriarch or the ultimate the owner of all of Egypt and everything in it. Well, Jacob in chapter 47, verse 27, just about, he's living, but then he's going to die. It says that the time of his death drew near. Well, Joseph's got a couple of sons. Joseph has a couple of sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And you think, wait a second, I thought those were tribes of Israel too. They are, because Jacob or Israel adopts them and makes them as sons. And so Manasseh and Ephraim become also patriarchs of the tribe of, or the tribes of Israel. And Joseph has this interesting blessing about the older and the younger, and you can read all that. But then in chapter 49, he speaks prophecy. He's about to die, so he speaks prophecy over every one of his sons, and it's fascinating because each one of the prophecies that he speaks, if you know Israel's history and you know the tribes of Judah and their history, you read this and you say, how did he know all this? Well, God was inspiring these words of prophecy as he spoke. And then chapter 50 shows us that he dies and he's buried in Egypt. And Joseph lives long and lives to see even the third generation of Ephraim's sons. So the great, 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 great grandsons, I might have thrown in an extra great. Ultimately, he died and was buried in Egypt too. And you go, oh, what a great ending to the story. Well, next week when we go into Exodus, there's a really disturbing thing because Joseph, you know, he's vice president of all Egypt, and you'd think that his family would be treated almost with royalty, but it says in the book of Exodus in verse 8 of chapter 1, now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And that's going to lead us into, as you know, the slavery for 400 years in the land of Egypt. Let's pray.